Thank you, Dr. Biker. Roman Catholic priest being introduced by the president of Calvin College. I explained to the Archbishop that Dr. Biker was the president of Calvin College. And so I said, well, it's kind of like the Gregorian University in Rome for Calvinists here in Grand Rapids. This will be the most authentic ecumenical encounter you have ever had, and we did not design it to be that way. It just is a conversation about the free society, but what results because of the quality of people and the honesty of people and the integrity. You see authentic tolerance demonstrated. In the common parlance, tolerance is really acquiescence, where we bend over backwards to make believe we don't have disagreements. We know that we have disagreements. Tolerance is not making believe you have no disagreements. It's having disagreements civilly. And that's what we try to model here. And on that note, I wanted to say that what Michael Miller said reminded me of a time where I was at an evangelical conference, a large, several thousand people, and I was with some escorts who were showing me around, and I stood out like a sore thumb in this gathering, dressed as I am. And I saw one of my escorters talking with somebody in the distance, and they were kind of looking over at me, and they were animated and looking over at me, and then they finished, and my friend came over, and I said, what was that all about? He said, well, kind of awkward. And I said, well, what? He said, well, he was asking me if you knew Jesus. I said, well, go back and tell him that not only do I know Jesus, but I know his mother as well. And I'm willing to make introductions. So welcome to Grand Rapids, the Rome of the Midwest. The great burden of this opening lecture at Acton University is the keen awareness that being on the verge of two decades old, the Acton Institute has built up a certain amount of steam. It was our intention at the outset not merely to make the intellectual and theological case for the harmony between the free society and a virtuous one, but also to build a network of kindred spirits, which you see around you, spiritual and intellectual cousins, if you will, who share some basic ideas in common, but who do not necessarily walk in lockstep unanimity at all times and in all matters. And here I am reminded of that maxim attributed to numerous authors, and I don't really know who said it originally. In necessaris unitas in dubiis libertas in omnibus caritas. In everything, love. Why in everything, love? What a manifestly confused word that has become. Despite the oceans of ink spilt in attempts to define it, I always tell couples that I'm preparing for marriage and at whose marriages I will officiate, that if I were love, I would sue for slander and misrepresentation of character. Now, in particular, we Americans, I think, are at fault in our use of this word. After all, no Italian would say that he loves his car. No, he loves his wife, not his car. In fact, it's very instructive that the colloquial expression for the love of a spouse or the love of a friend is for that person to say something that is theologically rich. And this is a colloquial expression. Ti voglio bene. That's how you'd say to a friend or to a spouse that I hold you dearly, I love you. Ti voglio bene literally means I will your good. how theologically rich that is. This definition of love is something that is more than a sentiment. It is a disciplined choice. It is an act of the will. I raise the question of love at the outset of what I know will be an invigorating exchange this whole week, because I think that by understanding what we mean by love, what we mean by human love, we gain a window into the human person himself. The phrase, the mystery of the human person, will seem odd, I think, to the strict materialist who sees man as essentially defined by his atomic parts. Shakespeare's Hamlet, having lost all joy at his father's death and what he sees as his mother's infidelity, grapples with this mystery, and he does so in great depression. He says, "I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, foregone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, this earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave overhanging firmament, this majestical roof fetid with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors." What a nice piece of work is man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in apprehension, how like a god, in beauty, the world, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? The contemplation of our nature, alternating at times between man's transcendence and his baseness, is nonetheless a necessary first step to an ordered liberty that is suited to our dignity. It was a frigid December day in 1974 when the Nobel Prize for Economics was presented in Stockholm. The presentation of the Nobel Prize is always a kind of intellectual coronation where the intellectuals are looked to in order to provide their plan for society. The recipient that year, 1974, was Friedrich von Hayek, and it is fair to say that he shocked his entire glittering audience by saying the exact opposite of what one might have expected him from a newly minted Nobel laureate. Instead of putting on display his vast knowledge, Hayek chose the occasion to draw attention to the utter incapacity of intellectuals to assemble enough information to reorder society according to their own designs. This constituted a rebuke to those who would presume the knowledge and intelligence not merely to override the rights of the human person, but to transform human beings according to their own conception of what a social being might look like. Here's what he said. Quote, "If man is not to do more harm than good in his efforts to improve the social order, he will have to learn that in this, as in all other fields where essential complexity of an organized kind prevails, he cannot acquire the full knowledge which would make mastery of the events possible. He will therefore have to use what knowledge he can achieve, not to shape the results as the craftsman shapes his handiwork, but rather to cultivate a growth by providing the appropriate environment in the manner in which a gardener does this for his plants." He goes on, "There is danger in the exuberant feeling of ever-growing power which the advance of the physical sciences has engendered and which tempts man to try, dizzy with success, to use a characteristic phrase of early communism, to subject not only our natural but also our human environment to the control of the human will. And then he concludes, the recognition of the insuperable limits to his knowledge ought indeed to teach the student of society a lesson in humility, which should guard him against becoming an accomplice in men's fatal striving to control society, a striving which makes him not only a tyrant over his fellows, but which may well make him the destroyer of a civilization, get this, which no brain has designed, but which has grown from the free efforts of millions of individuals. Close quote. Knowing what we know is important, and knowing what we don't know is also important. It is said that inscribed on the portal of the temple at Delphi are the words, "Know thyself." Now, this is something we can know. This, it seems to me, to be a good beginning, as good a beginning as any for thinking about the construction of society, a society worthy of the human person. After all, how we conceive of ourselves, what we are made of, what we are capable of, what rights, if any, we possess, all this and more will determine the kind of society we will eventually build. Like Shakespeare or Hamlet, we probe this question with a sense of wonder and even at times with a sense of despair or disgust. The very fact that we can wonder or be revolted or lose heart at the tragedy of a possibility not attained, all these are indications in themselves of our own dignity. We have the ability to self-reflect. We have the capacity not merely to know, but to know that we know, and to know that there exist some things beyond our knowledge. This capacity for transcendence takes place from within the realm of corporality, which is the first and most obvious thing that we know about ourselves and see in others. We are located in time and space, but somehow we know that we are more than that. We are made up of a biological component, but we are not defined by it. We relate to the material world and we depend upon it, but we do not ultimately discover our meaning in it. We transcend it. And here is something that is subtle and yet critical because of its subtlety, and it's often confused by sincere people. The relation of our transcendence to the body is not that of inhabiting a physical form. The Princeton University professor, Dr. Robbie George, will be with us this week. And when speaking in another context, he puts this very well when he makes this observation, quote, "What each of us is refers, what each of us refers to as I is identically the physical organism that is the subject both of bodily actions, such as perceiving and walking, and of mental activities, such as understanding and choosing. Therefore, you and I are physical organisms, rather than consciousnesses that merely inhabit or associate with physical organisms." Close quote. Now, I have the leisure of putting it more simply than a Princeton University law professor. Put simply, one may say that we are not spirits inside of flesh. We are spirits and flesh. Now, what proceeds from this anthropology in terms of human dignity and the construction of the free and virtuous society is vastly different from its alternatives. By holding these twin poles in tension, we have in place a corrective to any radical tugs to opposite and erroneous extremes, where truth may go mad, as Chesterton put it. We avoid, on the one hand, the reductionist trajectory that says that all things are relative. There is no truth, because if you simply deconstruct man to his essence, you have only a physical reality, no sublime, no transcendent core. But we also avoid a kind of heavenly mindedness that is no earthly good, to quote the Baptist preacher. Other than a useful homiletical device, this is critical to avoid because any ethics predicated on such a notion implies some kind of exogenous set of rules imposed upon humankind, yet intrinsically unrelated to human flourishing from within. Here on two fronts, we find the seeds of moral relativism that rejects the idea of morality and ethics as a set of objective obligations that emerge from the truth, the full truth of who human beings are in their origin, in their purpose, and in their destiny. Moreover, it is this anthropological, indeed cosmological, approach that enables us to argue that the is implies the ought, lest we find ourselves under the sharp blade of Hume's guillotine or in the murky swamp of moral skepticism, unable to distinguish good from evil, indeed even to be able to say whether there be a good or evil. This is what we are surrounded with in the contemporary culture. We see a version of this dualistic error in another set of twin heresies within socialism, or whatever they are calling the collectivism on the campaign trail these days. In confronting the existential fact of original sin, collectivists at once both deny and radically embrace human sinfulness. And here's how they do it. Sin is denied when the attempt is made to establish elaborate and all-encompassing systems of control, security, intervention, always for the common good, of course, that fail to take into account that whoever you may place in the position of controlling and intervening and supervising such systems is not immaculately conceived. Yet sin can also be seen as so radically pervasive to the extent that one believes that human beings can never be trusted to conduct their own affairs. While it is true that human nature contains the distinction between the corporeal and the transcendent aspects of our reality, this does not imply that the human person is some kind of schizophrenic entity. These two aspects of our character are what make up the human reality. This existential condition, undeniable to reasoning people, means that there is an interplay and an overlap, even while there is a distinction between the material and spiritual aspects of human existence. Marriage, I think, clearly and beautifully demonstrates this in the interplay between physicality and spirituality, especially when procreation is the result. The child emerges from the parent's love, an offspring, what a beautifully poetic way to put it, an offspring of their love, who is both spiritual and physical himself. This same kind of overlap, or what Jacques Maritain might call the effort to distinguish in order to unite, can also be seen in the social realm. And here we see that personal liberty dovetails with economic liberty. Let's look at it this way. The physical body is what places human beings into relation with the material order, with the world. And yet the human relation to the natural world is uniquely different from other beings that have bodies. Animals are bound to things not by reason, but by instinct. Human beings are bound to the material world by our reasoning. self-reflecting, thinking beings who survive primarily by the use of our reason. The human mind becomes the predominant element that makes humans distinctly human. Thus, people are both generically and essentially distinct from the animal, which cannot reason. And it is this rational relationship between the human person and nature that gives rise to property. Correctly understood, property emerges from the interplay between man's physicality and spirituality. Our capacity to reason enables us to relate to the material order in a way that is more than immediate and temporary. Our relationship to the physical is rather general and permanent. In fact, you could even say eternal if you believe in the resurrection of the body. Stability and permanency are the expression in time of the universality of the relationship of human beings to things. Nor is ours merely a relationship of consumption. This is such a popular bromide, to condemn consuming as though we had an alternative to consuming. Our relationship is not merely a relationship of consumption, but of possession, as I've said, in terms of property, but more critically, in terms of productivity. And property is the foundation and context of this relationship. By the relationship of the human person to nature, we leave the imprint of our individuality upon nature by means of the time, the risk, the ability that we extend, which in turn produces wealth and property. Wealth and property do not exist in a state of nature. They come into existence only when people place value on things and begin to define the manner in which they will be used to serve society. Consider the Mississippi River, for example. It was merely something to observe as a beautiful thing, maybe to fish for centuries, largely unnoted until its discovery for the purpose of navigation, for trade, for transportation. Then its value changed, and its purpose as a wealth producer became evident when the same resource came to serve the whole of society and improve overall well-being. In a state of nature, it is a body of water. When we add the element of human reason to it, it becomes an asset and serves everyone. Or think of the refinement and transformation of petroleum into energy, or sand into silicone, the means of communication that all of us are using, maybe even now. We see that in this light, you see, property, or the right to property more specifically, is really an expression and a safeguard of personal rights, not just the right to property. The defense of the right to property is not merely the defense of material objects in themselves, but of the very nature and dignity and liberty of the human person who has mixed his labor with nature to produce property, as Locke argued. The right to property is one way in which human rights are protected, exercised, and implemented. So you see, it's in this more holistic light when we approach topics such as globalization, when we attempt to understand the financial crisis that has impacted us, when we come to understand the possibility that a globalized market economy can indeed be an expression of globalized solidarity, where rich and poor are linked, producing a convergence that need not impoverish the rich, but enriches the poor, where the pie is no longer seen as a need of primarily being divided up and redistributed, but of being enlarged. with specific regard to poorer countries, this is practically accomplished by enabling them to jump over the technological barriers that originally confronted us in the United States. That now that the developed world has refined them, countries that are poor can get on the path to prosperity much more rapidly. In this view, the human person must be at the very center of our concern and our understanding, because economy makes no sense without reference to the human person. In taking the primacy of the human person as our starting point, we approach economics as a science of human action rather than as the juggling of mathematical abstractions. Not only do we avoid instrumentalizing humans with this approach, but we also come to understand that it is not so much people that are sacred, but the person who is sacred. The former is merely an abstraction. The latter is your friend and your brother and your neighbor. If man is all that I have said man to be, it follows that this being of immortal dignity, who bears rights by virtue of his very nature, as in the Imago Dei, must thereby have the right of the freedom to work out his or her vocation in this world. This is a concept of society drawn from the very nature of things. It gives us a grammar of conversation with all people of goodwill, not just Christians, but all people who are willing to reason. This concept of society, drawn from nature rather than from the utility of things, is a far more secure safeguard for civilization, as history's accounts of the temptations to power will attest. The great flaw of 19th century liberalism, which has a great deal to commend itself, was nonetheless this utilitarian foundation, which would eventually become mesmerized with the notion of getting things to function well, rather than the nature of things, and the moral imperative implied by such nature in themselves. Its boundless optimism in the 19th century was predicated on a flawed view of human nature, one that underestimated the capacity for evil to emerge from human nature, in which the mechanistic, social, and economic functioning was the whole control. The danger of a false notion of liberty or a false notion of the human person should then be clear to anyone who thinks about it for a split second. We speak here not so much of the individual as much of the person. We speak about the human person because the concept of person carries so much more meaning and depth. It enables us to understand the necessity of human beings' relations to one another, the interplay between their autonomy and their need for community, and the imperative to balance these dimensions so as to avoid doing violation and violence to the truth. The kind of society that emerges when the human person is seen as essentially a sum total of his material parts, and the kind of projections and freedom that he will be accorded under such a society, is radically different from the one that would evolve. Indeed, that did evolve, whose guiding anthropology was that of an immortal being, unique, unrepeatable, and destined for eternity. Similarly, a culture that defines liberty as license and as having no necessary connection to the truth of human flourishing will be decadent, oppressive, deadening, as we have seen throughout history, as we are observing presently. We do well to pause at this juncture to note a primary fact with regard to the free economy, which has provided such unprecedented prosperity wherever it has been permitted to function. The important issue here is not the laudatory fact of material well-being that emerges when one is free to act to his or her economic advantage and that of their families, the more primary fact and the first advantage which results in economic prosperity is this, the limitation of the state that the free economy demands as its precondition, and the limitation on the state that it imposes along with the protection it provides human persons, families, and their property. Let me repeat to be very clear. Economic prosperity is the result of people being allowed the freedom to engage in enterprise, because when they do so, they bring with them the whole of their knowledge, all of their talent, all of their experience and their character formation, and what emerges is a grand cacophony of diversity which may not have been the intention of any individual participant, but is nonetheless its result. If this sharing of intelligence over the whole of society is not obfuscated or obscured by coercive intervention, prosperity may be the result, to be sure. But the great benefit is that human beings are permitted to flourish. That is the main point. That an institutional arrangement is constructed under law whereby man may truly become man's greatest resource. Economists tell us of a truth about man, a truth about the human condition, a subjective truth. But economics does not, cannot, and was never intended to tell us the whole truth about man. It merely tells us a practical truth, not a metaphysical truth. It does not instruct us in morality, because the market economy simply facilitates the vices or the virtues of economic actors themselves. It can and will, the market economy can and will be as vicious or as virtuous as the human person who is its end and whose servant it must be. The free economy tells us some important things. The relative scarcity or abundance of goods and services and resources. The most efficient allocation of our own resources in our role as consumers. If we have an unobstructed economy, we can avoid the moral hazard that we have seen in this last year. We can act upon our subjective priorities. One can easily imagine what our lives would be like if we were, to one extent or another, impeded from having the information from that intelligence that the market furnishes. Indeed, we don't have to imagine it. We need only retrieve the business reports of the last 9 months. Or we can go back a little further and see the photographs in newsreels, or hear the testimonies and the memories of many people who spent long hours and long queues, hapless people who had the great misfortune to live under the socialist regimes. It is the restriction and marginalization of the state, and thus the enhancement of personal initiative, the voluntary communal bonds, that is the greatest achievement of the free society, and the threat it imposes to those bent on their quest for political and bureaucratic power. In conclusion, I would like to note something that is so manifestly apparent that to my mind, to say it is almost to be redundant, and yet is incumbent upon us to remember or to learn anew. And that is to pause and reflect on the events of the last two decades. The colossal wreck of collectivism in Central and Eastern Europe. Pray God one day in China, North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela should have permanently and irrevocably indicated the practical uselessness of socialism, that it was and remains, in Hayek's apt phrase, a fatal conceit. Yet it is a great tragedy and a testament to the fact that we only pretend to live in a world that takes imperial science seriously, that this failure has not only failed to teach lessons, the event of 2 decades ago itself is nearly forgotten, both by those who lived through it, and it's virtually unknown in the younger generation, which is why we are here tonight. But if we look back to the failure of mixed systems, we see the same phenomenon. The fascist system of Italy and the nationalist socialist system of Germany were also the cause of colossal wrecks. Closer to home, the New Deal purported to have fixed the Great Depression. But we realize that unemployment and production were the same or worse by the end of that long and sorry experiment as they were from the beginning. And so what do? We try it again, using the same anachronistic tools with the same destructive prolonging of human suffering. It's as though we have learned nothing from the overwhelming evidence of our culture's refusal to deal with reality. And it's also its boundless faith, it seems at times, in the workings of centrally designed social and economic planning. If there is a place for people of faith in this debate, it is precisely here. The science of economics, after all, began with people of faith, not in order to forge a new Gnostic body of knowledge, a secret way of understanding, a dualism of splitting the transcendent from the physical, but rather in order to spread the truth to all of humanity. This science belongs to us, and it is increasingly up to us to speak on its behalf. I began this talk tonight by drawing attention to the 2 dimensions of human experience, one physical and one spiritual. I do not believe that they can be separated intellectually, and I would urge you as you approach this week to keep both of these things in mind. It is true that this spiritual dimension is not usually discussed at events focusing on discussion topics like economics and politics. But I believe it's unavoidable, and I think we can all enrich our understanding by addressing it. It is sometimes said that the spiritual dimension of man deserves no place in settings that seek to be scientific. I don't believe this. It seems to me that Newman refuted this nostrum over a century ago in his Idea of the University. I seriously doubt that science can teach us much as so long as it seeks to gain understanding only from what we can see and touch and smell. The reason for this has to do with our tendency to presume that whatever we see and observe must be a fixed part of the universe, one that we inherited and that will always be present. This is a grave error, not just in theology, but in economics. It's a grave error in politics. It is a grave error in social theory, generally. If we want to truly understand human freedom and its place in the world, we must gain the capacity to think abstractly about what the world would be like without it. We need to imagine a past, for example, before the development of modern capital structures, to gain a full appreciation of what modern economic methods have, in fact, accomplished. We need to reflect on what we cannot see. We need to develop the capacity of imagining how the human condition would be very different and indeed frighteningly diminished in the absence of human liberty. Similarly, we need to cultivate the ability to dream of the blessings of liberty that we are denied when we refuse to grant it. The work that remains to be done, the work of this week, is to clarify in our own minds our understanding of these things, and then to extend that to our spheres of influence, that the choice between freedom and servitude implies for societies is a deadly one. We need to understand that the end of freedom truly is not merely having, not merely choosing, but living in a way that fulfills our moral and spiritual obligations in a manner compatible with who we are, with our dignity, with our nature, and choosing what is good for all temporally and transcendentally, rather than choosing things merely immediately. It is this intellectual project that I invite you to this week, where we can discover how to build and sustain a society that is both virtuous and free. Thank you very much.